you maintain fitness while avoiding burnout. The 3 training days were hard. Track work on one day, fast mid-distance tempo runs on the second, long slow distance on the third, but the cumulative effect was impressive, and the lower weekly mileage and rest days helped make sure I didn't injure myself again. The result? I cut 40 minutes off my marathon time and ran a 3:20:41, setting my PR and qualifying for the Boston Marathon for the first time by 19 seconds. But in the 5 years that followed, as I continued to train using the Furman method with my friends who were doing the same, I fell into Professor Fair's rut. I was doing the same thing at the same intensity, but losing speed as I aged. To go faster, to go much faster, cutting more than 7 minutes off my April time by the time November rolled around, I would have to run more, much more. I consulted the experts at Runner's World, including former Boston champion Ambie Burfoot, and they created for me an exact and demanding training schedule. It was daunting. My usual marathon training had me running 30 miles a week, perhaps 35 or 40 on those weeks with a 20-mile run on the weekend. This schedule would double it to 60 miles a week and beyond. I would do the runs on a strict schedule, changing from hill work in the beginning to build a base of leg strength to speed work and tempo runs along with long runs. One day in the schedule, about 12 weeks into the 16-week training period, called for a 10-mile tempo run on a Saturday, followed by 20 miles the very next day. Good news, I could slow down for the 20 miles. Thanks, Ambie. My training did not begin auspiciously. It was my own idea to inaugurate my attempt on my own record with a half marathon, a serendipitous race I was able to fit in while on a family trip to visit my then-in-laws at their home in a small town in Minnesota. As I walked up to the starting line, I actually thought of myself as a big city runner come to teach these country folk a thing or two about half marathonin'. Sure, it was 80 degrees out, but I figured I'd smoke my age group, then perhaps in my generous way, hang out by the finisher's chute and cheer on the local hoi polloi. Instead, 1 hour and 38 minutes later, I was flat on my back on the grass trying to suck in that soul-moistening, humid air of a hot Minnesota summer, thinking that giving in to death might be simpler. The idea of running twice that distance at the same pace, which I'd have to do to beat my PR, seemed less likely than spontaneously evolving wings and flying it. As I gasped for air, it occurred to me that I was beginning my quest to stop growing older, exactly how I had started growing older, in a New Jersey hospital room 46 years before, lying prone, trying to figure out how to breathe. The actual schedule began with 4 miles of running hills to build leg strength and prevent further injury down the line. That wasn't a problem, but the utter lack of hills in the glacier-polished plains west of Chicago was. Instructions were instructions, however, so my quest to turn back the implacable march of time began with me running up and over and up and over an overpass crossing the I-290 expressway. I hummed the Rocky theme to myself, but I could not hear it for the traffic noise. The schedule then called for a slow, gentle progression for the first few weeks, adding just a single day of running at first for 4 days a week. The tough part at first wasn't so much fatigue as getting used to a new daily or near-daily rhythm. I had always filled in my off-running days with another workout, a swim or a bike during my flirtation with triathlons, or a trip to the gym or a yoga class. Now there were no non-running days. Instead of trying to put on the right gear in the dark, spandex, flippers, both, I just got up, put on shorts and shoes, checked the assigned mileage, and stumbled straight out the door. I had thought of myself as being fit, but my muscles missed their days off and let me know. One morning during those first few weeks, I did 8 fast miles on trails on a Tuesday, then got up on Wednesday to run more as instructed, and my lower legs, groaning and creaking like wooden beams in an earthquake, simply would not cooperate. Instead of running, I sat on a park bench and negotiated with my calves. "Come on, guys," I said. "I know this is tough, but it's got to be a team effort. The lungs are committed, right, guys?" My lungs coughed assent, and we all agreed that all of my body parts would reconvene the next morning and see if we could get on the same page. By the end of August, though, a remarkable thing happened. The aches began to fade and then disappeared. I started to look forward to each day's run because each day's run was getting easier. My running style, under the evolutionary pressure of daily runs, began to adapt. Instead of lowering my head and churning my legs to press through the end of a day's run, I tried to relax, stay upright, and tread lightly on the pavement. I imagined my midfoot gently landing on the ground, lifting off, alighting again. Through miles of feedback and constant revision, unclenching my hands, lowering my shoulders, activating my calves and ankles, I started to change my running style to something that could last. It wasn't beautiful, but nothing hurt. About halfway through the 4-month training schedule, it was time to measure my progress. On September 11th, I joined the Runner's World editorial staff at the Chicago Half Marathon. I was feeling good, even cocky. In fact, I announced a bet. If I beat every other RW staffer and contributor, then I get to pick the cover model for an upcoming issue. I said this while pointing at myself and clearing my throat. One of the editors, the fastest runner in the assembled staff, took me aside and said, "I've got to beat you because if you're in the cover, sales are certain to tank." I've always hated this particular half marathon. Most of the course is out on the concrete surface of Lakeshore Drive, which turns into a rock-hard frying pan on hot late summer days, and my memories of it mostly involve trying not to give in to cardiac arrest as I staggered into the shade of the trees around the finish line. My PR for the course was a painful 1:29:23, a number written in blood and bile, and my goal for this race was simply to not give in to the perennial urge to kill myself on race day. I'd always believed that if you had anything left in your tank when you crossed a finish line, you were doing something wrong. If so, then today, applying a lesson I had learned at the prior year's Chicago Marathon, which I had run so soon after breaking bones in my back, I was going to do it wrong intentionally. The editor and I went out together at a smooth 6:50 per mile pace and kept it up, and even as the temperature rose, I kept my cool. He pulled away around mile 6, but I didn't care. Why? I was hardly racing, just out for a quick stroll with a few thousand strangers on a sunny day in the traffic lanes of Lakeshore Drive. At any minute, all of us might just decide to stop for a picnic. My pace was consistently sub 7 minutes per mile, and yet at the same time I felt completely within myself. I admired the trees and the grass and the concrete and kept running and loped in at 1:29:15, 2 minutes behind Brian and 15 seconds better than my course PR. I'd given up a chance to go after my half marathon PR, 1:28, and a chance to be on the cover of the magazine. I was even going to shave my chest, but I had gained something else, proof that success in racing did not have to equal misery. This was a revolution. My personal highlight film of major race days is a catalog of self-inflicted miseries, like one of those Faces of Death videos from the 80s. And if you had asked me why I endured such tribulations in what is ostensibly my hobby, I would have said, well, that's the point, isn't it, to see how much you can endure? The project had begun with the assumption that in order to run faster as I got older, I would have to suffer even more following a graph line of rising pain proportionate to speed. But it finally occurred to me, maybe success in running can be delinked from the amount of punishment you're willing to endure to achieve it. Maybe the point isn't to see how much you can stand, but to see what you can train your body and mind to do with less and less agita. Maybe the goal, as one ages as a runner and as a person, is not to learn how to suffer better, but to find your way toward a sense of ease and even, had I ever used this word in the context of racing before, pleasure. Is it possible in this fallen world to run fast and enjoy it? When a month later the dreaded day came, that 30-mile double long run weekend, I leaned into it. The 10-mile tempo run flew by, or rather it did, loping through my suburb at a ridiculous 7-minute pace, although as of that day it no longer seemed ridiculous. And the next morning, 20 miles at a 7:30 pace along the Chicago Marathon course during the race didn't seem hard at all. The last test before my marathon would be my neighborhood's 10K race. As I have described, my midlife running boom was inspired in part back in 2003, when I watched that 10K race go right by the house I had just moved into. I ran that race the next year, and every year after it, my time coming down from 45 minutes or so by 30 seconds each year, but never getting closer than 6 seconds to that seemingly impenetrable 40-minute barrier. If I was ever going to do it, this was the year, on a cool weekend, just 6 weeks before the Philadelphia Marathon, 10 weeks into the most rigorous training schedule I had ever endured, and while I was in the best shape of my life. I started the race fast, as I had been starting every run, fast enough to PR, but it would take effort. Since I had abandoned punishing myself to get faster, I used geekery. In the rebooted 2004 version of Battlestar Galactica, when they want to move the bulky spaceship a vast distance very quickly, the crew spins up the faster-than-light drive, not crank, not even the Star Trekian engage, but spin up, a phrase that evokes effortlessly increasing momentum. So after clocking 6:18s or better for the first 5 miles, I started saying to myself aloud, spin up, spin up. And so for the first time, I think ever, I actually accelerated in the final mile of the race. I came roaring around the corner where I live, past my house, waved without slowing down, and flew the final half mile to the finish at light speed or better, crossing as the clock ticked over 39:09, my fastest time ever by almost a minute. At 46, I had just traveled through time and shown up as my 17-year-old self. I was trained, fit, and equipped with faster-than-light engines deployable at will. I was ready for the marathon. The only sour note, my daughters hadn't been there to cheer as I went by. They were still inside the house. I got there too quickly, too focused on the goal ahead. 2 days before the Philadelphia Marathon, I realized I had no notion of what the course would be like other than that it would be about 26 miles long. So I consulted Ian Shillog, a weight producer, one-time Philadelphia resident, and a 2:39 marathoner. I asked him, any advice in the marathon? Shillog said, yeah, don't be stupid. Don't be stupid? Yeah, you're always stupid. You always go out too fast. So don't be stupid. You want a negative split this course. If you cross that halfway mark faster than 1:37:30, I'll hit you. I promised Shillog that if I arrived at the halfway point before 1:37:30, I'd stop and wait for the clock to tick over before going on. As I went to bed at my Philadelphia hotel the night before the race, full of noodles and spicy pig's ears from a hole-in-the-wall restaurant in Philly's Chinatown, I contemplated my secret, something I had told no one, not the Runner's World editors, not my running buddies, not Shillog. My stated purpose was to beat my PR, which meant sub-3:20. My informal public goal was 3:15, which would give me a 5-minute cushion in case something went wrong. But my secret goal, one which I dared not speak out loud for fear it could not bear the weight of the air, was to finish in under 3 hours and 10 minutes, requiring running a touch under 7:15 per mile for a touch over 26 miles. I had run a 1:29.5 with relative ease and a sub-40 10K. Why not a sub-3:10 marathon? Other than, that is, my advanced age and sparse natural gifts and the weight of my lifetime as a mediocre athlete? I tried to get some sleep, interrupted by fitful dreams of earless pigs mocking me for my presumption. Every marathon begins with a kind of boast. The crowd behind the starting line is divided into corrals, demarcated for runners at different intended paces so as to prevent chaos in the first mile, as faster runners overtake or even trample slower ones in front. But even in those overpopulated races with strictly assigned corrals, such as the Boston Marathon, within those corrals people edge forward or retreat backward as an expression of their confidence at that moment, as derived from a complicated calculus involving weather, what they ate the night before, and anything else that might be twisting in their gut. On this cool Sunday morning in Philadelphia, I had been assigned to the A corral, the first of three. At the very front of it were the elite runners, a smaller and less impressive group than might be seen at bigger, richer races like Chicago or Boston. And then behind them, the rest of us, people who expected to run the race in about 3:15 or under. This was ambitious at my age and size and weight, 46 years, 5'7", 175 pounds. But still, I edged forward, stepping around other runners until I could, mirabil visu, actually see the bony arms of the men who expected to win this thing. I wasn't expecting to challenge them, but I was imagining something perhaps just as unlikely. On cool race mornings like this one, runners wear throwaway clothes to the starting line to keep us warm until we are allowed to begin exerting ourselves. Some favor trash bags with holes torn out for the arms, but I think this is an unnecessary attempt at economy, not to mention unflattering. Any runner, any person, has enough old clothes redolent of sweat or spotted with paint or still smelling like the person who abandoned it in your apartment when they moved out. In my case, I was wearing an old NPR shirt produced for some long-ago marketing campaign. Although we hadn't started running, I wasn't feeling cold. Maybe anxiety produces heat? I took off the shirt and threw it into a bin provided so that discarded clothing could be distributed to the needy. I imagined a panhandler wearing the NPR logo, reminding passersby how much they relied on his panhandling, and thanking them for their support. This time I wouldn't have to wait for the first wave to go off, or the second before it was my turn. I was ready to jump at the first gun I heard. It fired, and I started to run. The field quickly spread, and I saw the elites lope away down Benjamin Franklin Parkway toward the towers of downtown at a sub-5-minute pace. For one brief moment, I enjoyed the once-in-a-lifetime experience of running in the pack behind the eventual winner of a marathon. Then they left me behind, and I concentrated on the race I had come here to run, the one against time. Running those first few miles through downtown Philly to the Delaware River, I felt effortless confidence, like an adept of jiu-jitsu, a tea ceremony master, a poker player with nothing but aces. A friend took a photo of me in the early miles of the course when I was reeling off 7-minute miles without any noticeable effort. And there I am, not only fit with my extended left leg as Jim Fix-like in its muscularity as it had ever been and ever will be, but also happy. I think about that day a lot now. I had always believed that suffering was a requirement for anything worthwhile, art, educational success, professional achievement, marriage, parenthood. On this day, I had found another way, though it had taken thousands of miles to get there. Mile 5 flashed by, and we were back into downtown with cheering crowds along Chestnut Street, and I felt great. I began to cultivate a feeling of holding back, like a bandage on top of an itch I really, really wanted to scratch. Another 7:05 mile. It was fast. It was very fast. But it felt easy. It even felt cautious. I wanted to run faster and knew I could. For the first time in any marathon, I began looking forward to mile 20, because it was then and only then, I promised myself, that I'd let myself tear off the bandage and go. Legs spun, 13 miles passed, energy gels were ingested, and we returned to the Museum of Art. The half marathon is diverted off to their finish, and we marathoners turned left to run around the building and head northeast on the parkway lining the Schuylkill River. If the first part of the marathon was a parade through Philadelphia's downtown core, the second half would be a trip out into the country, out and back on one road, 6 miles or so each way. The clock at the halfway mark read 1:33. I was way ahead of my stated goal pace and 2 whole minutes under my secret one. I was being recklessly, intentionally stupid. Ian was going to hit me, but first, I said to myself, he's going to have to catch me. By the time I hit the 20-mile mark on an uphill stretch in the riverfront neighborhood of Manayunk, that itch had faded. The marathon had reasserted itself, as it will. But even if I couldn't accelerate through the finish as I had at the 10K, I was still 2 hours and 24 minutes into a marathon with 6 downhill miles to go, and anything was possible, including, it seemed, the impossible. Then, tremors in my calves, those weird misfirings of nerves that feel like wires in your legs have been crossed, warning of cramps to come. It was calf cramps that cost me 15 minutes in the 2009 New York City Marathon. I'd watched my calf muscles spasm inward, leaving weird undulating half-inch indentations. And I wasn't going to let that happen to me again. I stopped dead near the 23-mile marker and spent 30 precious seconds stretching out my calves. "Behave!" I hissed at them. Would they listen? I started running again. I picked up speed. A mile flew by. No cramps. This was going to be amazing. A 3:05, maybe? Another mile zipped by, going downhill now. Gravity itself had signed on to Team Sagal. I got to the 25-mile marker, and boom! A gremlin whacked my hamstring with a ball-peen hammer, a sudden, vicious, explosive cramp. This had happened to me before as well in the 2006 Chicago Marathon, almost costing me my Boston qualifying time. And for a crazed moment, I refused to believe it was happening again and kept trying to run on one leg like Monty Python's Black Knight. I hobbled to the side of the road, stopping dead for the second time, and stretched out my leg on the fender of a car, pounding the muscle with angry fists, cursing it, pleading with it, while 3 whole minutes ticked away, and the 3:05 pace group streamed by me, puzzled to see a bald man arguing with his own leg by the side of the road. I was so close, in so many ways, to succeeding beyond my secret dreams. If I lost it now, a mile away from the start, and had to watch the clock tick past 3:20 as I walked the last mile, I don't think I could have borne it. I pushed away from the car and ran a step. The leg ached, but the ache faded, and the cramp did not return. I absolutely refused to baby that leg, and insisted on accelerating back up to a 7-minute-per-mile pace. It was crazy, but at this point I was gambling with house money. And if my leg fell off, well, then, damn it, I'd use it as a crutch to hobble the rest of the way. It seemed a miracle that this was possible, these steps, this mile, this whole race. I divided the last mile into quarters and started bargaining with fate for each one. "Just let me run this 400 meters, then you can tear my legs off." "Okay, thanks. How about one more quarter mile?" I came curving around the museum, and the crowd all seemed to be shouting for me. I saw something strange to my left, a group of men kneeling on the pavement, as if in prayer, around something in the midst of them, which might have been a person. And then I was there, through the finish line, my watch reading 3:09. I had done it, definitively, smashing my PR of 5 years earlier by more than 11 minutes. I felt flush with achievement, with the energy, if not necessarily the legs, to run a victory lap around the whole damn 26-mile course waving an American flag. I had accomplished something that Dr. Fair's statistics had predicted would be highly unlikely, if not impossible. But I did not feel as if I had pulled off some kind of miracle on asphalt. I felt, I knew, that I'd put in 4 long, difficult, painful, rewarding, exciting, revelatory months, my finest as a runner, transforming the impossible mile by mile into the possible. I had not reversed time or gotten any younger, but I had shown, at least to myself, that time and age are not walls, but fences, and fences can be jumped. A number of people, including Chillog, suggested that next I set my sights on a sub-3-hour marathon, which among runners is the informal barrier between being an excellent amateur and simple, objective excellence. Sub-3 people, while not quite the separate species that sub-230 marathoners are still different from the rest of us. If you run a 309 marathon, you're a great amateur runner, and you should be very proud, as I was. If you can run a 259 marathon, then you can do anything, including perhaps, depending on the day in the field, winning the thing. But no. I was exhausted, and I knew that the gains from further training would decrease logarithmically. I had to essentially double my weekly mileage to get my 327 marathon time down to 309. Shaving off another 10 minutes might require me to double the mileage again, and I was already pushing the limits of my family's tolerance, and perhaps my own. Besides, the ambition wasn't there anymore. I had started the quest out of a deep-seated fear of my inevitable deterioration. And now that I had reversed its flow, I was ready to relax and accept that now the tide would go back out. Beating back the ravages of time is a lot like trying to protect your sandcastle from the incoming tide, as I had done as a child and had done with my own children. You can delay, but never prevent the inevitable destruction. I had proved something to myself, that I could accomplish something once inconceivable to me, and I would guess to people who had known me either as the indolent brainy nerd I was as a child, or as the harried, slowly ballooning guy I had been in my 30s, as I was trying to juggle work and family. I was pleased, and I was proud, but I was also done. As the marathon receded into the distance, I couldn't quite figure out what to do with myself. I kept running 5 or 6 days a week rather than 3, but the intensity faded. And pretty soon, my great race was beaten ceaselessly back into the past. The next year, 2012, was the last year of my marriage with its many and increasing trials. And during that time and in the years since, I have often tried to hold on to that feeling from the early miles of the 2011 Philadelphia Marathon. Not the confidence or even, God help me, the sense of having been well and truly prepared for what I was enduring, because I knew, as my divorce unfolded, that I had never trained a single moment for that. No, what I have tried to remember and occasionally achieved is that sense of handing myself over to the moment I was in, trusting that what had brought me there would carry me through, allowing things to transpire, not with effort, but with something like ease, even grace. 10. When Eric Manser was 13, he was playing outfield for his youth baseball team in Ashburnham, Massachusetts. He had been an all-star shortstop, but was moved back to center field after he started misplaying harder-hit grounders. Standing in the outfield grass, he heard the crack of the bat 100 feet away. He looked up in the air and didn't see much of anything but light. A second later, he heard 2 distinct sounds, the ball thudding to the grass to his left, and to his right, more distant, a parent's voice saying, "I can't believe he missed it." It was around then, Eric told me, that he figured he'd better try basketball instead. Bigger ball. Eric was born with retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, a genetic disease that causes the slow, irrevocable deterioration of the retina, leading, in most cases, to blindness by the age of 40. Eric was diagnosed earlier than most at the age of 5, when his parents realized that he couldn't see at all in dark rooms. Night blindness was, in Eric's case, the first symptom of RP, but as the disease progresses, the result is an implacable narrowing of the field of vision from the periphery inward. By the time I met Eric 3 days before the 2014 Boston Marathon, he saw the world, he said, as if through a cardboard toilet paper tube, a small circle of blurry vision in front, nothing at all to the sides, above, or below. Perhaps because it was a lifelong condition, and perhaps because his progression was so slow, but mainly because Eric is Eric, he never let his condition stop him from pursuing anything he wanted to do. Once baseball became impractical, he turned to basketball, starting as the center for his high school team, Eric is a pretty tall drink of water, but then the night blindness took over and he found himself disoriented in the darker gyms. On a couple of occasions, he told me he would be planted in the paint, waving for a pass, and then he would receive it right on the bridge of his nose. So then, what came next? Swimming! A pool is brightly lit, the lanes are clearly marked, and all you really have to watch for is the big cross painted on the wall in front of you. Eric went toward swimming with the same energy he goes after anything, and even with just 1 year in the swim team, setting a high school record for the 50-meter freestyle that still stands. He managed to earn an athletic scholarship to Northeastern University. Let's pause here to remember that I quit my high school career as a competitive runner after 1 year because it was too hard, and I was tired of losing. And I can see. After college, Eric's journey to running was a lot like mine. He found a wife and a job, and eventually there were kids, and like a lot of ex-athletes, he kept up his eating and drinking while dropping the training, and found himself so overweight in his mid-30s that even with perfect eyes, he still wouldn't have been able to see over his belly to his feet. Members of his family had been runners, but he had always resisted. Now it seemed like the simplest, most economical way to lose the weight and get back in shape. First a mile, then two, then joining a runner's group, then a first marathon, then another. In April of 2014, at the age of 41, Eric had already run 12 marathons and a number of sprint and Olympic distance triathlons. In fact, it was his training for what would have been his first Ironman triathlon, 2.4-mile swim, 112-mile bike ride, and a marathon, that tore his meniscus some months before, forcing him off his feet. He had gained weight over the idle and indulgent holidays and started the new year determined to get back on his feet and back in shape. He knew he couldn't run at the level he had once reached, but like everybody else in the running world, he wanted to be in the course for the first post-bombing marathon. He contacted his friend Josh Warren and asked about getting on the team for Boston 2014. "Have I got a guide for you?" said Josh. Like Eric and everyone else who had been anywhere near the Boston Marathon in 2013, spectators, finishers, the thousands of runners who were prevented from finishing, and most bravely, some of the wounded, I swore immediately that I would return and run it again in 2014. Having gained some small amount of attention because of my proximity to the bombing, I was determined to leverage that publicity for the sequel. I came up with a plan to recruit an all-celebrity team of running guides who would compete to raise money for a team with a vision in the 2014 marathon. I scanned the list of celebrity marathoners and imagined trading good-natured trash talk with the likes of Christy Turlington and Apollo Ono in the months leading up to the race. But burdened by distractions and my own general lack of discipline, I wasn't able to pull it off. The only celebrity I successfully recruited was Drew Carey, who had in the prior years become a well-known runner, losing 100 pounds and finishing the Marine Corps Marathon, his first, in a respectable 4:37. As a runner, Drew, who had been our guest a few times on Wait Wait, was delighted to be offered a chance to run Boston and signed up immediately, but he had to drop out a month before the race with that most familiar of excuses. He'd been invited to compete on Dancing with the Stars. Ironically, he was voted off the night before the marathon. Should have come with us, Drew. So in the end, I threw myself on Josh Warren's mercy. "Get me in this race," I said. "Find me somebody to guide." Josh, unlike me, delivered. First, he was able to get me my own bib, usually a rare commodity and almost impossible to come by this year, so I could run on my own as an official entrant. But I wanted to guide again, preferably for a veteran or someone else who had lost his sight to violence. As the Boston Marathon itself had become a battlefield in the ongoing grind of the War on Terror, it seemed right and proper to honor somebody who had fought in it. But military veteran para-athletes have their own organizations, such as Achilles International's Freedom Team. So Josh had the next best thing, an athlete who was a hero in visually impaired running circles for his achievements on the roads and his advocacy for the blind, and best of all, because of an injury, he wasn't planning on running that fast. On the Friday night before the Monday race, I met Eric Manser at a reception for Team with a Vision at a mansion in Brookline, near the school the organization operates for visually impaired students. I was to speak to donors on behalf of the organization, and I was a little nervous about meeting Eric, who was delayed in getting there. Just like meeting William a year before, it felt like a first date that immediately became an arranged marriage. Mainly, I didn't want to disappoint him, either on meeting or during the race. Finally, he entered, a tall, bearish man wearing a visor and a grin, both of which rarely left his face in the time we spent together. Unlike William Greer, who didn't immediately register as a visually impaired person, Eric carried a white cane and had trouble finding my eyes with his as we greeted each other. We made small talk, and I introduced him to my parents and some friends who were there. "It's nice you were able to come for the whole weekend," he said. "Yeah," I said. "Where else would I be?" Marathon Monday, I woke up again at my uncle and aunt's apartment in Brookline and walked through the dark streets at 5 a.m. to the school for the blind a mile away, where the bus would pick us up and take us to the race. Eric was not there. Since he lived in a western suburb, it made more sense for him to go directly to Hopkinton. I climbed onto the bus with 50 other guides and runners, plus support staff, and we once again traced the route by bus that we would have to retrace on our feet. So far, so similar. But when we got to Hopkinton, everything was different. Security perimeters were set up at multiple points, each guarded by armed police. We went through so many checkpoints, it seemed like we were starting a race in Baghdad. Even with all our clearances and permissions, we could get no closer than 2 blocks from the Vision Center, where the uniformed police forced us to stop our bus and walk. About 25 sighted people then slowly guided an equal number of blind people as we all gingerly worked our way down the sidewalk to the comforting warm confines of the optometrist's office. I was worried. In the winter of 2014, my running had become ragged. I had missed most of my runs with my group, catching up with them on weekends when I wasn't out of town. Most of my runs were on my own and therefore slower and usually shorter. I'm not sure, and my records don't tell me, if I even managed a single 20-mile training run, usually essential to have any hope of success in a marathon. My running had become, really for the first time during my decade-long career as a middle-aged competitive amateur, a slog. I needed to do it, or I would have become even more anxious than I already was, but my spark was dimming. The only thing keeping it aflame at all was that sense of vengeance on the bombers and the people who said the Boston Marathon would never be the same, and most of all on the inner voice that told me at random moments, late at night or first thing in the morning, that my grievous family losses were irretrievable. It seemed to me, without any evidence, that running the marathon again, guiding a blind runner again, crossing the line again, might restore the balance of the world to what it had been before. And this quest, that impossible dream, would have to be a workable substitute for actually, you know, training. I'd lined up to run the Boston Marathon the prior year just as the unraveling of my family had begun. I knew that what was to come in both cases would be painful, at times difficult, but I was still somehow confident that it would all turn out well. William Greer and I finished in Copley Square and were greeted by an explosion. Then a slower-moving conflagration engulfed and wrecked my family. In general, that infamous year had featured a lot of unpleasant surprises. So this time, on the morning of the 2014 race, I adjusted my expectations downward. Way, way downward. Bottomlessly so. Eric wasn't at the Vision Center. He was delayed somewhere on his way to Hopkinton. I got myself another cup of coffee, found a quiet corner, sat down, and thought about Chris Gleason. I saw something strange to my left, a group of men kneeling on the pavement as if in prayer around something in the midst of them which might have been a person. Seconds later, I was across the finish line, having set my triumphant 309 PR at the 2011 Philadelphia Marathon, and yet, throughout the next hour amid the jubilation and bananas, I kept wondering about what I had seen. It was a person, I was sure of it. I could remember seeing his head. His head, yes, definitely a man, if only from the muscular arms and hairy leg. The torso had been blocked from my vision by the men kneeling around him. Men in uniforms. Police? No, not dark blue, and they didn't have heavy equipment on their belts. Red and white uniforms. Red and white? EMTs? Yes, most likely EMTs. At the Runner's World post-race party, as I happily gobbled up the cookies I had been denying myself for the past 4 months of training, people came up to me and asked me how I did, and I told them, and they marveled and grinned and congratulated me, and I asked them, if they knew anything about that one guy I saw lying on the ground near the finish in some kind of medical trouble. And eventually, somebody did. The rumor was that he had died. News reports flashing across our phones confirmed it. A runner had died, right near the finish line. Witnesses said he had collapsed to the ground just before the timer above the finish line turned over 3 hours, so I would have passed by a few minutes later before he could have been moved. That was definitely the man I had seen on the ground. Later news reports gave his name, G. Chris Gleason, of upstate New York. My fleeting encounter with Chris haunted me for months after the race. I can still see him in his last moments of life, or more likely right after them, splayed on the ground, flat on his back, peaceful, as the seemingly reverent EMTs tried to save him. I Googled his name every other day for weeks, hoping a news story would be posted explaining the cause of his death. The internet never gave that up, but I learned a lot about him. He was 40 years old on the day he died, a happily married father of two small children, a lawyer, and a force in the endurance sports community of upstate New York, known for his constant presence at races, training runs, triathlons, and the chat boards and websites devoted to that community. On the day of the Philadelphia Marathon, he was already a two-time Ironman finisher, with no known medical issues whatsoever, an amateur athlete in his prime. Hell, he was fit enough to run a sub-3-hour marathon, which he would have if he had survived another 100 yards. What stopped him? The curiosity burned hard enough for long enough that I ended up contacting his wife. Jennifer Gleason, by then a widow for almost a year, demonstrated a grace and grief that I've thought about many times since and have tried and mostly failed to emulate. Part of it is her strong religious faith, which provides her and her children significant comfort. It was just his time, she told me. God said, okay, I need you, this is it. So he's up there, and getting everyone to run a little farther. Be better, stronger, don't talk about it, do it. That explanation is at least as credible as any other because the autopsy indicated nothing. No toxicology, no hidden flaw in his heart, nothing. His heart just turned into a bag of worms, said Jennifer, quoting a doctor who was as mystified as she was. It's called cardiomyopathy, which is a medical term for we have no idea, and it happens from time to time to marathon runners, mostly male, mostly in the latter part of the race, and often right near the finish line. Some speculate that the burst of adrenaline or extra effort, just like the one I felt as I came around the curve to see the finish line and then Chris on the course in Philadelphia, is the tiny bit of extra stress that topples the function of the heart. How often does this happen? A comprehensive study done by the Cardiology Division at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, studying race data from 2000 to 2010, shows that of the 10.9 million runners who ran a marathon or half marathon in those years, 59 experienced cardiac arrest at a rate of about one runner per 200,000. And yet, even with solid numbers of how many die in the attempt, the study's authors concluded that, quote, marathons and half marathons are associated with a low overall risk of cardiac disease and sudden death. Because as it happens, you have a much higher risk of dying of cardiac arrest if you are obese, have high blood pressure or cholesterol, and or are indolent, all of which are factors that can be alleviated or eliminated by, it's here somewhere, oh yes, here it is, what a surprise, running. But marathoning remains special, and especially intimidating, because to run one goes far beyond what is merely required for good health or weight loss or an improved physique. To simply run makes excellent sense. To run a marathon is to go beyond sense. To risk something, maybe everything. The marathon has been associated with the risk of death ever since the event was invented by Pheidippides, who came in first in a field of one and then promptly died. Whether he existed, probably, or actually ran from Marathon to Athens to deliver news of military victory before promptly expiring from the strain, probably not, the marathon, based on his legend, was born with the notion of sudden death wrapped inside it. Mortality comes standard. Here's something Winston Churchill actually did say in his youth. Quote, nothing in life is so exhilarating as to be shot at without result. Such a truth implies that people seeking exhilaration will tend to put themselves in situations where they might, in fact, be shot at, literally or figuratively. And indeed, even at my most physically and mentally exhausted, my teeth chattering and my mind blank from hypothermia, Boston 2007, or my legs rigid with cramps, New York 2009, I was still, as I stumbled through the chute and clutched at my medal, thrilled. I had tempted fate. I had flirted with Pheidippides. I had dangled myself as bait before the Grim Reaper and scampered away before he could catch me. I had survived, so far. What if today would be different? I was without question going to do something I was not adequately trained to do. I was under extraordinary stress, involved in a difficult divorce that was now in its second year and showed no sign of resolution. My journey from 2013 to 2014, from one Boston marathon to another, had also seen me go through a complete transformation, a sudden detour into the nether regions. Dante had completed his own infernal journey by descending to its utmost depth and then piercing the border and passing through to purgatory and then heaven. Maybe I would follow. Maybe I should. So many times over the past year on my motorcycle on my couch, I had contemplated whether it would be better to end my particular Divine Comedy now before it got any worse. I had been a dramatist once, and surviving the 2013 bombing to return to the 2014 race, and then to run it all the way to the line where death would then return to claim me after my narrow escape the prior year, that was poetic, whether just or not. I could live with going out that way. Enough, I thought to myself. Nobody was going to die today. The last thing Boston needed was more bodies. I got up from the floor of the Vision Center's examination room. Eric still wasn't there, so I did a local TV interview without him and had a bagel and chatted with other runners and guides. There was Aaron Sheedes, one of the premier blind runners in the country, who was looking to set the visually impaired marathon record that day. Jen Shelton, so fast, she once famously outran her first guide and arrived at the pickup point for the second guide, sightless, alone, and shouting for directions. There was Ron Abramson, a wiry lawyer from New Hampshire, and Dan Streetman, a former Army Ranger, who had both, like me, volunteered to be marathon guides, and unlike me, looked like they were in shape to do it. Eric finally arrived, delayed almost an hour as he tried to get through the security cordon around Hopkinton, but seemingly unperturbed by his travails with his grin and visor intact. As I was to learn, much like William Greer, Eric never complains about anything despite his surfeit of reasons. Maybe I could absorb some lessons from him. After all, he also found it difficult to see his kids. I was known around Team with a Vision for my tasteful sense of humor. We went over again how he liked to be guided. Unlike William, he had run with guides many times, and he had a preferred technique. He carried a tether with him, a 3-foot length of bungee cord with loops at each end. I would carry one end, he the other, not so much for navigational guidance, even with the many changes to the marathon security measures since the prior year. It was still the same course, pretty much a straight line from Hopkinton to Boston, but for reassurance. He was perfectly capable of putting one foot in front of the other and running in a more or less straight line, just like William. But in a massive crowd, the blind or visually impaired can feel disoriented. Add to this his night blindness, which meant that what registered to me as a shadow from a tree, say, blocking the sun just for a moment, would be for him a complete and instant blackout. Perhaps this is less true for people blind since birth, but even with Eric's composure, confidence, and achievements, he still couldn't help reacting viscerally to the sudden onset of the dark and the threat of the unseen. My job was to provide reassurance as much as guidance. I could do that, I thought. Talking to Eric, joshing with Josh, meeting the other runners and guides, each of them bouncy and jittery and raring to go, I found myself getting excited to run the race. I started to forget the events of the past year and remembered what had been a base note under the dirge for my family. My determination to be here on this day and do this as a gesture of defiance and resurrection. In an interview with the Chicago Sun-Times right after the bombing, I had said I'd like to send a message to the then-unknown bombers. Go fuck yourselves! The Sun-Times didn't print it. The two bombers were now respectively dead and in prison, but it was still a message worth sending, and this was the best way to send it, en masse and in motion. It was time to head to the starting line. We walked out into the sunshine. It was a beautiful day, cloudless and sunny, perfect for photographs, but perhaps not so much for marathon running. Marathoners are like tuna salad. We go bad in the heat. The starting corrals were nuts. With the added mazes of fencing and security, our bibs were checked 3 times before we found our way to the actual roadway. We couldn't even get up to our assigned corral, and so we settled for the one behind it. But that was a stroke of luck, as we found ourselves next to Dan and Ron and their assigned runner, Corvin Bazgon, a 39-year-old living with Usher syndrome, which is essentially retinitis pigmentosa combined with hearing loss. He had Eric's limited field of vision, and without his hearing aids, sweat wasn't good for them, he couldn't hear much. So I remember him seeming blissed out above it all, grinning in the general direction of his two guides and us. With all of us wearing our bright red Team with a Vision shirts, we felt, well, like a team, if one with variable levels of vision. It was 11 a.m. on April 21st, 2014. There was a horn. We started to shuffle forward. I held tightly to the loop in the tether. Eric had doubled it so as to keep me closer in the jostling crowd of the start. I looked up at him. His eyes darted around. He took in the scene around him in tiny sips, as if he were trying to drink a cocktail through the little plastic stirrer. He was grinning. After a few moments of shuffling, I once again reached the starting line of the Boston Marathon. I had lived a year filled with catastrophes, only one of which was a bombing. But for the next 4 hours or so, I would not be a father bereft, a tragic hero living out my own private opera. I would just be a guide, I would never finish the race if I dragged all that with me. So I dropped all of it on the pavement and ran. The first 7 miles flew by, quickly realizing we could and should have joined forces. The five of us, three guides, two runners, formed a kind of flying wedge. Dan took the point, using his West Point bred authority to quietly but firmly issue commands to runners in front of us to make way. I noted, enviously, that there was something about his tone that caused people to almost jump out of his way without even a look back. I told him I wanted to hire him to precede me through life. He laughed without losing focus. I had let go of the tether as Eric felt comfortable running free in his protective cordon. We all felt great. We fed off one another's energy. We talked. Ron had also gone through a divorce and remarried. He expressed condolences for the death of my marriage. This time I didn't go on about it. Why bring up anything sad in a day such as this with such a group in such a place? Ron and I took turns relaying cups of Gatorade from the aid stations back to the runners under our watch. We waved to the crowds. People cheered us on. We nodded to express that variety of gratitude that indicates complete agreement with the praise offered. All of us were smiling as much as Eric was. Heavy metal played from a speaker at a water station. "It's Dio," said Eric. "I love Dio." "So," I said, "you're deaf too?" Everybody laughed, and we ran on. Nothing good can last forever, and so it was with our impromptu group. Eric wanted to run at a faster pace than Corvin, so we said and shouted our farewells, and everybody wished everybody else good luck. Eric unfolded his tether, which he'd been carrying in his hand, and put his fingers through the loop on one end. I held on to the other, and I led him on toward the halfway mark. The sun reached its peak at noon, blazing down on us. I cried out, "Blind runner coming through," trying to emulate Dan's tone of unquestionable command. It was immediately questioned. "Could you not do that?" asked Eric as gently as he could. "I just don't like taking advantage of my condition." He would have mentioned that to Dan, he said, but everybody was having so much fun with the flying wedge of blindness that he didn't want to kill the mood. Fair enough. I held on to the tether and kept going, trying to lead him clear of other runners. Whenever Eric got into a tight group of runners, he started to feel uneasy. Again, understandable, if you imagine running surrounded by people you can hear but can't see. The same situational anxiety meant we ran well to the left and away from the shouting woman of the Wellesley Scream Tunnel. I shrugged an apology at them. "Get your girls next time!" The sun continued to beat down. Eric fell silent, and so did I. The day was going to be a lot tougher than my run with William for a number of reasons, which is why I started to panic when the drugs began to kick in. I wonder, sometimes, how and why none of the therapists I consulted over the years, from college to just before my marriage exploded, diagnosed me with depression. Perhaps my symptoms did not present as treatable via medication, even after the advent of Prozac. Perhaps I masked it by being clever and funny, which is how I had masked a lot of things. But in the fall of 2012, around the time I found myself having to wait until I stopped sobbing before leaving the car, a BMW 3 Series, the number one car for middle-aged men to sob in alone, and entering the house, I realized I quite literally could not survive without medical intervention. I contacted one of the shrinks I had seen and more or less demanded chemical help. He was willing, and I ended up entering the growing population of the psychoactively medicated. My medication, Cymbalta, was helpful, very much so. There were many, many times during the year and a half since I had started taking it when I was dealing with some extraordinary interaction with my children or their mother or some setback in the expanding legal fight where I was able to both comprehend how bad things really were and yet stay on my feet dealing with it while knowing that my unmedicated self would have been driven to wailing, crumpled misery. I was often depressed or upset or sad or angry, but with good reason and within reason. The world no longer presented itself to me only in varying shades of black, and because of that, I chose every day to remain in it. That important benefit aside, I didn't like the side effects. I had gained weight and experienced an intermittent dizziness. The good news is that it only happened on rare occasions, and then only when I engaged in intense physical exercise, like, you know, running. The sun was at its apogee and the heat was starting to matter, but still I shouldn't have felt this woozy, fuzzy, and dizzy. This was a common experience in the last year, something that had affected my training significantly. Worse, I had left my pill bottle in Chicago when I flew to Boston, so I might have been dealing with withdrawal, which seemed to manifest as an intense increase in the drug's side effects. I tried to focus. I ran. I wobbled and straightened and ran some more. If it had just been me, I would have stopped running and gotten off the course and sat down and had a cold drink and maybe a cigarette. Who knows? This running thing was not working out. Maybe time to try another vice. "Hey, Eric," cried somebody to our right, looking back over his shoulder. It was a runner with a Team with a Vision bib that read guide, but there was no blind runner to be seen around him. His name was Monty Harville, and his guidee had blown up, as we once said in more innocent times, just a few miles in, so once Monty delivered his runner to a medical tent, which would tend to him and transport him to the finish line, he continued running the race. Why not? It was the 2014 Boston Marathon. Who wouldn't want to run the whole thing? I knew somebody. As soon as I saw Monty, and he fell in with us, forming another, albeit smaller, flying wedge for Eric, I realized I had been given an out. For the last mile or more, I'd been hanging on for Eric's sake, and now I was being released from that burden. Maybe. There was an aid station coming up. I maneuvered around, so I was running next to Monty and said, "Look, I'm having a real hard time. Do you think you could take over for me?" "Sure," he said, seemingly glad to be occupied again. I dropped back a step and ran next to Eric. "Eric, I'm sorry, man, but this heat or something, it's getting to me. I have to stop for a while." Eric told me later that he knew I was having trouble because I had stopped talking. "Don't worry about it, man. If you have to stop, let's stop. It's fine." "No," I said. "Monty's got you. I'm sorry, but I'm just falling apart." We said our goodbyes and thanks and apologies, and I edged to the side of the road, stopped running, and walked up to the aid station. A volunteer handed me a cup of Gatorade. I thanked her and stepped off the course to drink it, and to watch Eric and Monty vanish down the road. I stood there, my heart pounding, my head still spinning. I drained another cup of Gatorade. This was worse than death. This was failure. In the end, just as I had feared would happen when I guided William the year before, I had promised somebody I'd be there for him, and I couldn't do it. I cheesed out. I hadn't been strong or dedicated enough. I'd blown it. Well, add the 2014 Boston Marathon to a long list of things attempted but not conquered. Marriage, fatherhood, lawn maintenance, baseball. I got another cup of Gatorade, and as the runners streamed by, I thought about Jacob Seelheimer. I ran the 2007 Boston Marathon as a qualified registered entrant into the teeth of a freezing rainstorm in about 3 hours and 30 minutes. I was 41, had trained hard and well, and was in the best shape of my life. Jacob Seelheimer was 26 years old, 6'2", and 360 pounds, and he had started out so far behind the last registered entrant he hardly counted as a bandit. His final time? Somewhere north of 8 hours. He's not exactly sure. I had never met Jacob nor talked to him, but I knew about him. While I was training for Boston 2007, somebody had pointed me to his website, What Would Jacob Do? Pictured there was this indolent, obese man who had decided to, quote, run the Boston Marathon on a whim without adequate training, physical capacity, or, of course, qualifying or registering for the race. And listener, I hated him. Not personally, of course, though my disapproval of everything about him took on an emotional heat. I had trained my guts out to qualify for Boston, and then again to run it decently, and this guy, who gave his weight at 450 pounds at the start of his training, just decides he's gonna run the Boston Marathon by shuffling down the course long after the rest of us? Not only was it an affront to my achievement, it was a terrible idea. Anybody with any ounce of sense knows that deciding to go from couch to marathon is exactly the wrong way to start running. Decide to do something impossible. Make yourself miserable attempting it. Maybe die from a coronary. Good idea, pal. I ran the 2007 race and flew back to Chicago and checked in on Jacob's website. There were pictures of him running the Boston Marathon by shuffling down a sidewalk and framing him. Ha! And then, with a last smug sniff, I forgot about Jacob Seelheimer. Except I didn't. I thought about him from time to time, usually as the dumbest runner I had ever heard of. I might have mentioned him in that capacity once or twice over the years. Maybe it was just a lingering affront from his stealing our glory. Maybe it was a weird side effect of my fixation with weight, there but for the grace of obsessive running. Go I. Years later, I decided to make some use of this odd but persistent memory and write about him for Runner's World as an illustration of what not to do, the goofus to my gallant. But if I was going to do that, fairness required, I actually talked to him. Thanks to Facebook, it was easy to find him in Andover, Massachusetts, where he works as a tax consultant, and thanks to NPR, he recognized my name and was happy to talk to me. Jacob had always been a big guy, but also an athlete. He played football as a lineman at Colby College. But after his graduation, his father died, and he had to go to Texas to help dispose of his family's beekeeping business. And, well, he told me, I was stressed, depressed, unsure, and was eating and drinking way too much, and by the time I went to law school in New Hampshire, I weighed 450 pounds. He had some friends there, who regularly joined the crowds of bandits who ran the Boston course after the official entrance every year. This, of course, was before the post-2013 crackdown. And in January 2007, one of those friends, Mike Moran, urged Jacob to do it with them. That very year, 3 months later. He was trying to find a way to help me to not be so fat, Jacob told me. So he said, you can do it. You just have to get in decent shape. And I said, okay. And then he put up a website and sent a press release to all our friends. So I figured I had to do it. Driven almost entirely by a desire not to quit in front of his friends and the world, and also by a glimmer of hope that the Boston Marathon could help him get out of the pit he was in, Jacob turned himself over to the effort. Mike had told him he could lose 100 pounds in just 3 months of training for a marathon, so Jacob bought a stationary bike and started pedaling. I should say here, if only for legal reasons, that attempting to lose 100 pounds in 3 months is a terrible idea. Most experts say that a healthy rate of weight loss should be no more than 1 or 2 pounds a week. I knew it was a bad idea, Jacob told me on the phone, laughing. I've made a life of bad ideas. He hauled himself on top of a stationary bike for 30 minutes a day, then worked his way up to 8 hours a day sitting on that bike. Then running. The longest Jacob ran prior to the marathon was 10 miles, which took him about 3 hours. And the weight dropped off. By the time he got to Hopkinton on Monday, April 16th, 2007, he was down to 360 pounds, an astounding loss, just 10 pounds short of his goal. But, Jacob points out now, he lost 10 pounds during the race, so he made it. The crowd of qualified and then charity runners, myself somewhere in it, had long vanished down East Main Street out of Hopkinton, and Jacob and his three friends, Mike, Luke Webster, and Andrew Fleming, started out after them into the cold driving rain. A fourth pal never appeared until he showed up drunk in Kendall Square many, many miles later. For the first few miles, I'd be running, and I'd see the water station ahead, Jacob remembers, and then from a half mile away, I could see them tearing it down. There were no crowds, no Wellesley Scream Tunnel, no support. Instead, when he needed hydration or nutrition, Mike or Luke or Andrew would jump into a 7-Eleven and grab some bottles and bars. As I talked to Jacob, I began to realize that whether or not my marathon that day was more legitimate, his was a hell of a lot harder. He got to the 10-mile marker, thankfully painted onto the asphalt because all the signs had been removed, on pace at about 3 hours, but his race fell apart at around mile 17. And this, it turns out, Jacob and I did have something in common. In his case, although his strength and breath were holding up, his feet were wrecked. I could barely walk, Jacob told me. My feet weren't trained to endure the bone-crushing weight for that many hours. The last 8 miles I could either sprint or sit down. Sprinting seemed to take the weight off my feet, so I'd sit a little, then I'd sprint, then I would have to sit down again. It took twice as long to do the last 10 miles as it had the first 10, and we got lost in Brookline and we ran an extra half mile or so. But nonetheless, Jacob persisted. He and his friends slowly made their way down the sidewalks of Brookline in Boston, and then, just like every other Boston marathoner, he sprinted down Boylston to the finish line, albeit hours after the race was over and in the dark. Some guy in a bar yelled at him, "You think you're running the marathon?" And Jacob responded, "Fuck yeah!" And then he celebrated by hurrying back to law school in New Hampshire, where he had to perform the next morning in a mock court exam on his feet and quickly purchased shoes 2 sizes larger than his normal size because his feet were so swollen. 8 hours in the cold, wet, and dark. The weather had been so miserable that the organizers actually considered canceling the race. To end up with nothing to show for it but swollen feet. Did Jacob regret his run? Absolutely not! It was one of the best senses of accomplishment I've ever had, he told me. Since that day in 2007, Jacob has managed, fitfully, to keep the weight off. He's at 350 pounds now, and has also kept running, but never again in a marathon. Maybe I'll work my way down the opposite way most people do it, he mused, laughing. Start with a marathon, then a half, then a 10K, then a 5K, then I'll quit. But he has had plenty to endure nonetheless. First Lyme disease, and then practically the same day he got engaged.